You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast. Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast. This is episode 169 with Jason and Jamie. And today we're going to look at one of the questions of apologetics as it relates to the miraculous work of God, one of the things in modern skepticism of the Bible today is, were these stories really true? You know, the Bible accounts for, obviously, a lot of the miraculous or divine, if you want to put it that way, where God interrupted the order, the scientific processes in the universe in one way or the other. I mean, obviously, you've heard, if you are familiar with the Bible at all, about Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, or of course, Jesus raising himself from the dead. And those particular aspects have a great body of historic evidence to support them. But you have others that are also brought into common question in this modern era as well. And one of those, Jason, is as it relates to the question of the Exodus, the story we get from Genesis over to then the book of Exodus, where the story really unfolds. And it's worth noting that obviously this was something that God had promised to do for the people of Israel long before, right? If you go back to Genesis chapter 15, God's telling Abraham what was going to happen over time in the future. And he tells him that the people of Israel will be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. And then afterwards, they will be brought out by the Lord back into the promised land, or the land that the Lord had for them. And so that promise was made, of course, long before any of those events ever came about. And so we can see that God guided and led these events. And then, of course, the story itself really comes down to a battle of the gods. We get that in Exodus 12:12, where Yahweh, the one true active living Lord, says that he's going to bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. You know, it was really a, who is actually the Lord here? Is it Yahweh or is it the gods of Egypt? And brought the people of Israel out of their oppression in Egypt. And of course, along the way, it's quite a miraculous story. And so, Jason, this is a, I think, great question, and certainly one that some people bring up. I'd say, from my experience, it doesn't seem to be as common as many of the other challenges to the work of God in some of these other biblical accounts, but still a legitimate question. And I think there's definitely people out there asking that question. And you, I'm sure, have a much broader understanding of that and maybe have interacted with more people on that line of thinking or scope of questioning. So what would you say in beginning and engaging that question about the Exodus account? Is it real? Is it historic? Did it really happen? Did the Lord really do the things that the Bible says he did?
Yeah, I think it's always good to just kind of remember how much skepticism has really run rampant in our culture, and to kind of have that in the back of your mind, especially as a believer who's wanting to share your faith and you want to be able to be talking about the Bible with confidence. And even if you don't have all the answers, say all the evidences in mind or all the archaeological inscriptions in mind when you're talking with somebody, but just as kind of the undercurrent of confidence, knowing, okay, what I believe really is founded in history, it's founded in truth, it's founded in science, and it's not merely that I've been taught this, and so therefore I have to believe it. It's that, okay, this is truth I'm talking about. I'm sharing a well supported case when I talk about Christianity. And I would say, just like with any of the big miraculous stories of Scripture, whether it's Noah's Ark or even the creation account. Or if you look at the cases of Jericho falling, the walls falling down, and Sodom getting destroyed by God, any of these examples from the Old Testament or the New Testament, where God's power is, we could say, just more powerfully on display, you're going to have people challenging that. You're going to have skeptics who are saying, wait, there's no evidence for it. And so with the Exodus account, what you basically have is those who want to refute it or deny that this is really God's word on what happened, is they will try to make the case that because the Egyptian annals, so the historical records that they have found put out by the kingdoms, the kings of Egypt, they have no record of Hebrew slaves leaving Egypt, especially this mass exodus that you have in the Bible. And you definitely don't have the plagues being talked about, where all the gods of Egypt get destroyed one after the other. And so people look at that and they say, well, that seems like we got a pretty good case for there not being an actual exodus. And maybe there's the people of Israel wanted to have a exciting story, you know, explaining how they came to be a nation and things like that. But the big thing to point out is people don't like to talk about their faults and flaws. And it's, you know, if you talk to any Egyptologist, they will tell you that the royal annals record their victories. So their military victories are always talked about. More often than not, they're probably exaggerated, because there's cases where it doesn't seem like the Pharaoh could have accomplished what is ascribed to them. And sometimes, you know, they'll even make outlandish claims. Like one Pharaoh claimed to be able to row a boat faster and farther than 200 sailors, you know, things like that. It's bordering on the ridiculous. It is ridiculous, in fact. But what you won't find is a record about, oh, this Pharaoh was a coward. He never did much. And he was always letting slaves run away, you know, things like that. You're not going to find that in the Egyptian annals, because that's embarrassing. Nobody wants to have that be recorded. And you might even remember, if you've seen the movie The Ten Commandments, there's this part where Moses is exposed as the guy who killed an Egyptian defending another Hebrew. And even though Moses was this prince of Egypt, his, you know, he's now become a disgrace in their eyes. And you see the Pharaoh saying, his name must be stricken from all the records. And in a sense, that actually matches up with, obviously, that exact portion of the Moses story. We can't say that actually happened based on the Bible, but it does match what we know about the Egyptians and how they would not want to record things like that that are embarrassing. And so it's just a matter of, okay, this is human nature that we tend to see. People like to talk about their victories, and that explains why there would be no record in their annals.
And it's worth noting too, Jason. Oh yeah, it's worth noting as well that this is not unique just to, you know, that one particular country or culture. I mean, I'm thinking of like one of the biggest historic defeats was when Persia went to war against Greece, right? And you have two battles that were pretty incredible. One was what the movie 300 was, you know, made of. I forget the name of the king there, but you know, this group of 300 soldiers that were able to camp out in a pass and literally hold off the entire Persian army. That's really embarrassing. And you look at the Persian history, Persian record of this event. Well, it never really happened. In fact, what the Persian historic record shows is that they were en route to go fight Greece, and then of course the gods came to the king at night and told him to turn around and go home. And so he's like, oh yeah, that's what happened, right? Well, that's not what happened. And the only reason we know what happened is because you also have the Greek side of the story, which is, you know, ultimately what. And then same thing happened in a great sea battle that literally destroyed the entire Persian entire Persian armada, if you want to call it that, whatever they call that. And again, is that in the historic record? Well, no, it's not. And you could even say America is like this as well. I mean, where's the story? Where's the real account of us leaving Vietnam? When I took history classes, I never heard anything about us, you know, when we pulled out of Vietnam. We actually left so many people to their death. And it was a very shameful, you know, shameful thing. I'm sure when we write about our exit out of Afghanistan in a few, you know, years, 50 years from now, it'll probably be a blank story there as well. So all that to say, like, there's a lot of historic record evidence to say this is a common practice all over the world. And so it's not hard for us to imagine that's the case there.
Oh yeah. And it's interesting even to like see cases like where Nero, for instance, blamed the Christians for the burning of Rome or a good portion of Rome. And even Tacitus, I think it is, says, you know, this blame was affixed to the Christians, but basically implies, yeah, that probably was not the case. So even you have cases where, you know, you'll have a leader claiming something and then the other people saying, yeah, he's not right about that. And so it's how it goes. But with that, just, you know, having said that, is why there's this vacuum, so to speak, of information in the Egyptian records. We really do have a lot of archaeological evidence in support of the Exodus event. And that begins with just recognizing there is strong evidence, very powerful evidence for Hebrews and Hebrew slaves living in Egypt before the time of the Exodus. Now, there is a debate about when the Exodus actually occurred, even among good, you know, biblical scholars who, everybody's done their homework, and they still come out to, some will say, the 13th century BC. A minority will say the 12th century BC, and then probably the second most is the 15th century BC. And that's what I hold to. I think that it matches not only the chronological records, but it fits, more importantly, it fits the biblical timeline. And we have a biblical date, if you would, a timestamp of when the Exodus occurred, when in the first Kings, when Solomon is building the temple, there's an important portion of that where it says that, First Kings 6:1, there it is. In the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. Okay, so that's a very specific time. And because it's almost universally agreed that this beginning of the temple, this building of the temple began in about 966 BC. Because of that information, we can then look at, okay, what is 480 years before that? Because that's what the Bible says. And that gives us the date of 1446 BC. So again, you know, you don't need to be necessarily dogmatic about the exact year, but I think that so long as you're understanding this is a historical event, the Bible always treats the Exodus as a real historical event. It never talks about it like, you know, like the myths, for instance, in ancient Greece, they have their myths, which talk about like the origin of fire and things like that. Those don't have a historical context. And that's so important for people to understand. Mythology just reads so differently from ancient history. Ancient history gives dates. It says this is the explanation. And it gives regions and names of leaders at the time and things like that. The same thing that you would do when you're reading the Gospels. You see, this is meant to be read as history because of all this information given. But mythologies, ancient mythologies, would not even bother with that because it's folklore. It's something. It's a nice story that kind of makes people sort of feel good and maybe something to tell the grandkids around the campfire, something like that. But it doesn't have substance to it, if that makes sense. And so because the Exodus is always treated in a historical way, it's only right for us to read it that way. The other thing about the Exodus is it's pretty clear that because of archaeological evidence, we know outside the Bible, we know that there were Hebrew slaves in the Bible. So this is what we see from, for example, a papyrus called the Brooklyn Papyrus or Papyrus Brooklyn. It's very interesting. It gives a list of Semitic names, and then it gives their Egyptian name that they'd be given, just like Joseph, when he became the prime minister, essentially the prime minister of Egypt. He was given an Egyptian name. That was also true of the, you know, Daniel and his friends. They're given Babylonian names. It's the way of kind of indoctrinating people into the culture. Well, this same thing happened, and there's a list given, and all the original names are Semitic, which means they are people of a Mesopotamian or Canaanite region origin. And some of the names are even matched up with other Hebrew names that we find in the Bible. And that's what's really fascinating is the name like Shifra, for example, is one of the Hebrew midwives mentioned in Exodus 1:15. That very name, not saying it's the exact same person, but that very name is mentioned on this list, which really gives powerful support for Hebrews living as slaves in Egypt. And the fact that, you know, that explains a lot. You know, it fits with the Egyptian pharaoh's ambition to build many massive structures for their empire. It fits with, you know, the Hebrews coming down there for grain originally with Joseph. And it explains why the Egyptians didn't want them to leave. They were very useful to build all these projects.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting too, Jason. I think one of the aspects to evidence is the trustworthiness of the source, because that plays into it a lot, right? And like you're just talking about, hey, here's some documentation that is reliably accurate and, you know, affirms what the Bible teaches. But I'd also say the Bible itself is a form of evidence that has a lot of claim towards the legitimacy of what it teaches. And you see that with so much other evidence, right? So many different stories. Obviously, like I mentioned before, the resurrection of Jesus, that is a very historically documented event. And same thing with the raising of Lazarus from the dead. Again, a very historically documented event. But even some of these other challenges that have come along, I'm thinking like the question over whether Pontius Pilate really existed, right? That was a big thing a few years back. And then they ended up finding inscriptions that were to Pontius Pilate for his, you know, donation to the construction of an arena in one case, and I forget what the others were. But again, you know, it's like, well, not a surprise. Of course, Roman history also has the historic figure, and so we know what happened to him and all that kind of stuff. But you look at the overwhelming evidence, and if I have tons of evidence to believe something is true, then even when it comes to things that maybe there's less evidence for, I still don't have as much question, right? I mean, I don't have any evidence that you actually worked in hotel management, right? You've you've told me you have, but I don't have any evidence of that. I obviously didn't know you at the time. I didn't know you pre-seminary, so I don't know what you were doing. I don't know what was going on in your story, and I don't know anybody who knew you, right? So there's no body of evidence I can point to say, oh, that's a real story. But what I can point to is the credibility of the person, which is the things I can verify are all true and they match the accounts you've given. Therefore, I don't have any question whether that in fact was a part of your story, because obviously you haven't lied about all this other stuff. So why would I not trust you when it comes to something like that? And so I think that plays into it as well, because you're never going to find 100% evidence for every single solitary thing. And I was pointing this out to a guy, you know, the other day. We were having a conversation about historic evidence, and what I was trying to impress upon him is just the wealth, the unusual wealth of historic evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, because it is massively higher than you would expect for any historic documentation. And I was telling him, so let's say 100 years from now, I'm trying to prove you existed. Would I be able to find thousands of, you know, first-person proofs? Well, no, of course not. Why? Because nobody's writing about you or me or him, right? We're not remarkable characters. So maybe we'll find some mentions in public record documents. Maybe we'll find some old social media posts, right? Maybe we'll find, some other things that might yield to some kind of evidence. Maybe somebody authors a book and you find a copy of that book, you know, I mean. But the point is, you would not find a lot. I think you'd be hard-pressed, for most people, you'd be pretty hard-pressed to find a lot of evidence. And yet we wouldn't go, oh, because there's not a lot of that evidence there, that means obviously the entire account didn't happen.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because that's just the nature of archaeological evidence, that you're not going to have a confirming piece for everything. First of all, there's so much that hasn't been excavated. And that in part is exciting, because that means we still have a lot more to discover. But that's why we call it circumstantial evidence, because if it supports the circumstances that would have to be true for the biblical story, then it's supporting it, because it's not denying it, it's not refuting it, it's actually giving credible reasons. So an example from the resurrection is that in all four Gospels, Joseph of Arimathea is named as the person who buried Jesus, who had Jesus buried in his own tomb, his own new tomb. And you think about, okay, why would they all have the same name, first of all? That's pretty good evidence right there that is accurate. If they had different names, which would be very easy for that to happen, if it was manufactured, then you would expect different names. But they all have the same name. And the fact that he has said that he's a member of the Sanhedrin is really surprising, because the Sanhedrin is the body that just condemned Jesus to death. They just condemned him to be crucified, handed over to Pilate to be crucified. And so that is a very, very unlikely circumstance. Not only would manufacture the name and all have the same name to work with, but that they would come up with a name that belonged to the group that condemned Jesus, rather than, you know, one of the disciples, you know, oh, there was Peter or John bravely going and asking Pilate for Jesus's body. That's what you would expect, but that's not the case. It's this Joseph of Arimathea guy. We don't even know anything about him other than that he's a member of the Sanhedrin and that he's rich. but other than that, we have no clue where he comes from, but that actually fits with circumstantial evidence. That's what you normally would expect if a story is true. Now, with the Exodus, what you have is cases like when Moses is said to kill an Egyptian guard who's beating a Hebrew slave. When we have murals, actual murals and inscriptions talking about this very thing, where the guards would beat their slaves. And in some cases, that was their motivator for working harder and things like that. And we actually have this. This is something we see in archaeological data, is they were unashamed. It was their way of saying, yeah, we showed them that they were going to be obedient slaves. They kind of bragged about it. And that fits with the narrative we have in Exodus, because here we have a Hebrew slave on the verge of death. And then Moses steps in and ends up killing this guard to rescue the guy. What I think is probably maybe one of the most powerful pieces of circumstantial evidence is the Ippur papyrus. And this is because of what it speaks to in the Exodus story. Obviously, the 10 plagues, if you're talking about Exodus, that is a major highlight of what's going on. God's in the Bible, God says he's bringing these plagues to execute judgment on the Egyptian gods. And these plagues are pretty impressive. I mean, we're talking about the Nile River turning to blood. Okay, it's hard to come up with a naturalistic explanation for that happening. Or all the livestock of Egypt getting wiped out while all the livestock in Goshen is just fine. Things like that. These are very severe plagues. But in the Ippur papyrus, what we have basically is an Egyptian sage. So this is not any record within the royal annals. This is a guy on his own writing about this. And it's like a poem or a prayer. Some people call it a prayer to the sun god Ra. But he talks about all these disasters that are striking the land. And he is just dumbfounded by everything that's happening. He says, basically, the Egyptian empire was so glorious, so powerful. How did it come to this? He says the king has been overthrown by the rabble. He says that the river is blood. You know, just think about how this matches up with the Exodus account. He talks about death lurking everywhere. He even says grain is being destroyed. Well, that matches with what the Exodus account says about hail and locusts destroying the grain. And then he even talks about like physical ailments and people having disfigurement. That fits with the boils that are described. All of this is circumstantial evidence. We can't say, oh, look, Ippur papyrus gives absolute 100% proof, like a math proof that the Exodus happened. But what it does do is it supplies very powerful circumstantial evidence to support what we can know to be true from the Bible.
Well, and how many other times in history has a river turned into blood? Right. I'm not familiar with even one other one. So even if you're trying to justify, speaking to a different event, what event? You know, there isn't another event that speaks to. Very specific to one singular event for a specific reason. I think you pointed that out in a sermon recently, just how that really was God reminding the people of Egypt what they had done in, you know, murdering all the Jewish babies, throwing them into the river like they had done. I'd never made that connection before, but I was like, well, that's a really good point. That God's like, hey, reminding them in all of this that it wasn't just a random thing, right? We think, oh, it just turned the water to blood as a random thing. And no, it's actually a reminder of what they had done and the cost of their sin in this case. That's pretty cool, which also, again, speaks to the truth of it, that it's not just random things. It was God specifically working for a specific purpose, doing a specific thing.
That's right. Well, and just as kind of a final piece of evidence to consider, this is one that, again, it's circumstantial. So don't see this as like, okay, this is not going to be a one-for-one proof. But what we see in the Exodus account is that Pharaoh's son, firstborn son, dies, right? That's the final plague, the death of the firstborn. Now, this would have been a pretty big deal, because this is the pharaoh to be. This is the guy who was supposed to be on the throne after that pharaoh. Now, in our archaeological records, what we know is that Amenhotep II, which he is the pharaoh who in all likelihood would have been pharaoh during the time of the Exodus if it was 1446 BC, as I take it to be, his firstborn son was also named Amenhotep. Okay, I know that can be confusing, but Amenhotep II had Amenhotep III, or he was just called Amenhotep. He didn't give that title, the third, but he was he shows up in some of the early records, and then he suddenly vanishes. Like, he's supposed to be king next, right? Because he's clearly the firstborn, and then he disappears. And this other guy named Thutmose IV comes in, and he ends up being the king after his father, Amenhotep II. And here's what's really fascinating. If you ever visit Egypt, you should look for this. In between the paws of the Sphinx, there is a inscription there. It's called the Dream Stele. And on that inscription, you have Thutmose IV saying that he had a dream where the god of the Sphinx basically said, if you clear away the sand around this, the base of the Sphinx statue, you will be granted the throne. You will inherit the throne. And it's a very interesting thing. Like, why would he have to justify the fact that he gets to be king? And it fits if he wasn't the rightful firstborn. And oftentimes you'll see this in history where, you know, a king has his firstborn son ready to be king, and then that king or that son dies. And then there's a little bit of like a crisis, like, who do we have replace him? Is it the king's brother? Is it somebody else, relative? Or does somebody else vie for the throne? Well, oftentimes the secondborn doesn't just get the throne. Sometimes a lot of blood is shed, actually, because there's people vying for the throne. But in this case, the secondborn is given the throne. And this stele that is still there, you can still go and see it, basically gives him this quote-unquote divine justification for why he gets to be king. It's because he had this dream and he did what the gods asked. And that is just, to me, it's really powerful circumstantial evidence, because there's no reason for that unless his firstborn brother, which is mentioned earlier but suddenly disappears, died in the plague just as the Bible describes. And so, I mean, that's the final piece of evidence that we'll look at today. But just knowing there's archaeological evidence out there and it supports this stuff, and the fact that you can go and look at it today is pretty astounding. So my encouragement to you is if this is something that is interesting you, then look into this more. See if your questions can be answered as you do research and investigate some of this yourself.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.